Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it? Podcast like it's 1999.
Podcast like it. Just podcast like it. Podcast like it's 1999. Podcast like it.
You want a podcast like it?
1999.
Welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999. I am your host alone today, Phil Liscope, with Tom Meissen, you know, just the best.
No substitute for Kenny, let's face it.
You in this particular instance, unquestionably. Because I'm sure we'll not surprise our listeners. Kenny Neimert doesn't really know much about Bjork. You know, he has a cursory knowledge of her, and certainly likes what he's heard and seen, but didn't feel like he would be additive to this conversation. So it is just going to be Tom and I today. I say just, but let's be real. This is a real gift for you to come on and talk music with me, because I think it's safe to say that our friendship was birthed on music. I remember
Day one,
sitting at the Fox commissary with you, talking Radiohead and Bowie, and yeah. And so when
while
I reached execs out
upstairs in the screen test, we're going, Wisdom, because we didn't tell anyone, and someone said, "I think he's with Phil." fucking Phil.
I was on several occasions told you can't just take the lead actor of our show, but truly. You know, I reached out to you about Bjork, not surprised to hear that you're a fan of hers, but, you know, she, I want to kind of, from 30,000 feet, we're going to talk about, All Is Full of Love, which is the single that was released in 1999. We're going to talk about the music video, the groundbreaking music video that to this day is still held up as sort of, you know, one of the bastions of, music videos. But I want to kind of go back and just sort of, how did you first hear Bjork? How did she come into your life? Like, what was, do you remember?
How did I first hear Bjork? I mean, I was aware of the Sugar Cubes, but sure. I think I must have been too young to be into them. Because that was
late 80s, yeah.
Yeah. But I was aware of them, and I was aware of this voice. It seems as though her voice, from the moment I'd reached early adolescence, was just always around, and whenever you heard it, it made you stop, no matter what age of shitty pubescence you were in, where everything is just a slog.
But wouldn't you also say too, you know, and I'm sure that you'll love me saying this, but, you know, the Brits are kind of at the tip of the spear when it comes to, or at least Europe is really kind of pushing musical boundaries more than, you know, this hemisphere. And I think that, like, Bjork obviously is from Iceland, for those who don't know it. Mm-hmm. I just feel like at this time, especially in the 90s, right, when I think that, you know, music journalism out of the UK really sort of thought very highly of itself, and understandably so. do you know what I mean? Like, this, it's not a surprise that Bjork would be talked about perhaps a lot more in your neck of the woods then.
Well, I think that probably, especially in that time, in the 80s and the 90s,
yeah,
it seemed as though music was really responding to British society. And society was kind of going along with it. Whereas a lot of other periods, society was leading music. Whereas music was really, it was, or rather music was following, whereas this was really representative from, because we'd just gone through Thatcher for years of Thatcher, and everything was shit.
Great music came out of Thatcher, though. Well, this is it. Libertarian, like, you know, against
this is it. Yeah. From Thatcher, where everything was awful, and she, like a lot of conservatives over here, hate anything creative. Presumably because creativity encourages empathy, and I don't think they really like people to empathize.
They also tend to be socialist.
And what, you mean once you start actually thinking about
I think that artists tend to be more empathetic, more sort of like thinking about causes and what have
so
you.
So it encourages
We can't have that. We can't have that.
No, absolutely not. So Thatcher especially savaged the arts, and out of necessity comes invention, and that's why it was a real boon in theater and in music and in film. So much good came out of it because artists and creatives were just trying desperately to
rail against
funnel
it.
What they can. Yeah, quite, and that's why punk was such a huge thing over here, because fuck Thatcher and fuck the royal family.
Then you also had your Britpop movement that comes out of the, you know,
which
the
comes
mid-90s.
Out of post Thatcher. So Thatcher leaves. You had John Major, who was just kind of there, just a grey man in the corner. But the joy of Thatcher being done, and so Britpop was really entirely in the early 90s. You had rave, and you had the Manchester scene. With, you know, the Happy Mondays and everything that was going up in the... Yeah. Madness were earlier. Madness were the 80s. And with everything going on up at the Hacienda, which was a famous club, and the Acid House. But Britpop really was purely about let's just enjoy ourselves. Yeah. So much of it is just about, you know, larking about down the park, playing football, smoke a fag, and then see your mates, have a beer.
I mean,
in
that's
the
Parkland. That literally is
that's
that.
That's Parkland. That's Blur. That's Supergrass. Yeah. That's Dodgy. That's the Supernaturals. It's all just sunny. Let's enjoy it because Ding Dong, the witch is dead. Which actually, when Thatcher died, that song was released. Someone covered that and it went into the charts.
That's fantastic.
Isn't it?
I mean, dark, but fantastic.
I don't know whether to condone it or not publicly.
What's coming out of all of this, though, is the electronic scene, right? So you have electronic music, which is starting to kind of seep into alternative music.
Yes.
Which is really where Bjork finds her lane, right? I mean, I think that she's in the club scene very much so. She's, you know, she's working with like Tricky, and she's working with Massive Attack and all these various sort of, you know, dubstep,
the Bristol,
whatever you want to call
Bristol,
it.
They hated the term, but trip hop with Tricky trip-hop. And Massive Attack and Portishead and
all that stuff. And she's sort of on the wave of that, specifically with her first two albums. Debut and Post are really big. First of all, very successful albums, but also quite poppy, big dance, you know, club hits where, you know, all that kind of stuff. And you know, Debut is successful. Human Behavior is her first big single. You know, that's obviously a big deal. Big Time Sensuality, all that stuff. Post is when she really blows up. That's Army of Me. That's Hyper Ballad. It's Oh So Quiet. You know, all that stuff. And it's an enormously successful album. And she's not really prepared for that level of success, I would say. If you haven't seen the YouTube clip of her attacking the reporter that tries to get in between her and her child at the airport in Reykjavik.
Only a few weeks ago, I was in a coffee shop in London. And there were a couple of kids who were working there. They must have been early 20s at the latest. And one of them was talking about the manager and how they dictate what the music is in the... Mm-hmm. He said, "Oh, I got such a bollocking because I put on Bjork the other day." And this other kid said, "Bjork? I don't know. I don't think I know Bjork." And the all he said was, "Oh, she's the one who punched a photographer."
God damn
like
it.
That's yeah, it. I that mean, can't yeah. be it. That's it.
It's like that and the Swan dress, unfortunately, Swan seem to be the things that, the Oscars, that really kind of follow her around. You know, it's interesting. I first started listening to her in high school. I think we're talking like 1996, 1997 is about the time when a friend of mine bought me Debut. She was an artist that I was kind of like, you know what, I should get into Bjork. And my friend was like, you know what? And he bought me the CD. And then I just... honestly, in a matter of weeks, bought everything she had at that point and became just legitimately obsessed with her. But I'll say this, I fully understand people that hear her voice and are just like, no, right? Like it's nails on a chalkboard to certain people. I understand that. I don't agree with it, obviously, but it's a very specific voice. It's a Joanna Newsom voice. It's a voice that is so idiosyncratic and so original, people don't know really what to do with that.
I think also when it's something that's so unique, her voice is, there's no one else who sounds like her. And yet it's not put on. I think that's where people struggle, that can't actually be her voice.
There's also,
I love it.
I love it to death. But I also think this also taps into something else. Which is that people think it's a shtick, not her voice, the whole persona, like the Swan dress. She didn't wear it as a bit. She wore it because her friend made it for her and she liked it. And she wears it on the album cover of the album that came out that year as well. But still, you know, because she's so pixie playful, what have you, I think there's such a misinterpretation about her that it's a bit. And I bring this up just because I remember, as I'm sure you do too, when Lady Gaga hits the scene, and I'm not sitting here railing on Lady Gaga. There's a lot of her stuff that I really love. But she and her whole persona, her dresses, her meat dress, her this, that, and whatever, felt like, not that she was stealing from Bjork necessarily, but that like she got a pass because it was part of a whole thing, whereas Bjork got kind of hit with it because it was artistic, if you know what I'm saying. I think that people think it's
the difference between the two seem to be when not knocking Lady Gaga.
Yeah, yeah, no.
She'll be relieved to know I'm not knocking her, I'm sure. Is that you get the sense that it's by committee. There's been a lot of people brainstorming and it's gone through a lot of drafts. Whereas everything with Bjork, you can imagine her walking around Iceland and ideas are just popping into her head and she goes home and she and someone else will make that come to life, whether it's her music or whether it's her what she's wearing or the stage shows that she puts on. Yeah. It all feels like you just know that it's come from a really magical, uninhibited part of her.
Absolutely. I think that this all really comes back to, and you know, she walks a very fine line. And I say that with all the love in the world in terms of how she sort of navigates this pop culture icon making accessible music, but with a thesis statement and an artistic expression. That's a hard thing to do. A lot of people wouldn't even attempt it, quite frankly. You know what I mean? I think that the swings that she's taken over the course of her career, over the 9 albums that she's made, each one of them is so drastically different from the other, and yet it all feels like a piece of her. Each one of them has a thesis statement. Literally, like each one feels like its own, you know, project in a way that is sort of different to the one that came before it. But I also feel like, you know, I went to see her recently. She was in LA and she was touring Utopia, which was the album that came out in 2017. Tom's shaking his head in disgust.
I'm so jealous. That album so much.
It's phenomenal. I think it's the sixth time I've seen her, sixth or seventh time that I've seen
six.
Her. Yeah.
I'm only on 3.
She's there. There's no one like her. This show, and I posted some photos, and I'll put them on our feed. But it was a full on living art project, unlike maybe any show of hers that I've seen up until this point. Just a truly sort of all encompassing experiment that we were all just a part of.
Which album did she released an app?
Yes, that was her Biophilia.
That was Biophilia, wasn't it?
Yeah, when she used a Tesla coil.
I mean, come on.
Come on. She's a fucking Tesla coil.
If it was by committee, then enough people would have said no. But she did.
I mean, when you see that thing lower during a show, you're like, people might die. This thing looks really dangerous. Like, I don't think this is a good idea.
And how is that not Spinal Tap Stonehenge?
Right? Exactly. This is the thing.
But it isn't.
Yeah.
This is what's so incredible about it. Now, I remember I spoke to a friend of mine who's Icelandic about Icelandic music.
Yeah.
Because I love Sigur Rós. I love Mum. I love Ólafur Anson. They're just so many amazing musicians that are completely unique and completely individual. And there was a period over here where it was, they were suddenly very, very popular. And I remember saying, what is it about Iceland that just produces such incredible musicians? And they said, it's because in Iceland, there are only about 20 people who live there. So you don't go into anything for fame and fortune. You do it because, you know, all of the stuff that you say you should go into the arts for, because you need to do something. You've got a voice and you want to express it. And that's completely true with Icelandic musicians, because you're not going to make money. You're not going to be famous, because there aren't enough people to, everyone's famous in Iceland. Everyone knows each other. And there's not enough people to pay you to make you rich.
I remember I read a quote of Björk's years ago when she was asked about when she was in the Sugar Cubes. And she was like, listen, there's nothing to do in Iceland but get drunk and fuck between the houses. And I think that that's just emblematic of just sort of, which is why, like, there was kind of a punk scene. You know what I mean? The Sugar Cubes were kind of a punk band. And it is interesting to think that, like, you've got the Sugar Cubes and you have what Björk did, then you have Sigur Rós. Those are all very different sounding things.
Yeah.
And yet they all feel weirdly at one in this volcanic.
I feel like it's come from getting drunk and fucking between the houses. Under the Aurora Borealis.
Exactly. So in 1997, she releases Homogenic, which is, I would argue, her best album, one of the best albums ever made, in my opinion.
Album. Yeah.
It's unbelievable. And it is birthed out of her fame that she gets off of Post, and she really kind of crawls inside herself a little bit. She strips it down. It's really just beats and strings. Those are the only instruments that are used on the album. It's a lot of her manipulating her voice. She also unfortunately had this stalker that tried to kill her. That happened around the time of making this album. So it all kind of made her reevaluate fame and reevaluate what she wanted to be doing.
I've just remembered, didn't she get sent a video
of him killing himself? Yeah.
That was him.
Yeah. She had a stalker who sent her a bomb, and the bomb didn't work. It didn't go off. And in it, there was another package with a videotape of him having killed himself. It's a whole fucking thing. Super dark and really upsetting. And obviously had a tremendous effect on her. She moved from Iceland to London, where it was originally to be produced at her home in London. That's when she got the thing sent to her in London. Then she relocated to Spain to finish the album. And subsequently, I think she lives in, I want to say she lives in New York, or at one point she was living on a barge with her daughter. I don't know. So, I mean, she's, it is what it is. But
in London, I think.
Yes. She's got a bunch of different houses and a bunch of
I know someone who briefly lived on a barge. She was subletting from a burlesque dancer with a twitch.
Are you serious, though?
This is completely true. And the next barge along, Nick Cave was his barge.
Of course.
And a couple along was Damien Hirst, and Bjork had one of them.
Of course. Someone needs to make a movie about this barge culture.
This community of barges.
So that's fantastic. So she releases Homogenic in 97. She's got a couple singles that come off the album. Yoga, which is one of her best songs. Bachelorette, Hunter, Alarm Call. And then the last one was All Is Full of Love, which comes out in 1999, in May of 99.
Which you said that she, and I read this a couple of days ago, about her recording it in Spain. And so surrounded by lots of people being very creative. Yeah. And then suddenly it ends when the album's finished, suddenly it ends, and she felt desperately lonely and went for a long walk around the Spanish countryside and just started singing All Is Full of Love, and that's how the song was born.
Yeah, it was basically, the album was done. I think that it had not been intended, the song was never gonna, like, this was, the album was finished, and then she has this sort of moment for her. It was inspired by Icelandic mythology, like Ragnarok, but also was about sort of new beginnings. She wanted to end the album on a more optimistic note, especially after
what
Pluto.
What was the penultimate song in it?
Pluto, which is fucking crazy. So it's just like, she felt like she needed something to slot in there after she screamed at people for 3 minutes with Pluto, which is understandable. But she talks about how she called the song about believing in love, expressing that love isn't just about two persons. It's everywhere around you. Even if you're not getting it from person A, it doesn't mean that love isn't out there. But she also described it as, quote unquote, taking the piss, considering it a sort of a sugary song and one of her most sort of like saccharine songs that she's ever done, which I think there is this kind of acknowledgement of the fact that she's written something that is, I mean, Death Cab for Cutie covered this song. Like, I think on some level she has to acknowledge that, like, she's made this sort of hard on your sleeve song, which is not really her thing, but
up until Vespertine.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And then she fell in love with Matthew Barney, and that album's all about being in love with a man, a goat man. So yeah, it's it's All Is Full of Love is a beautiful song, but I specifically remember, and I don't know if you do, but this video got a lot of play. I feel like even in Canada, and I say that with, you know, I love
even
Canada,
in Canada.
Even in Canada, I felt like this. I want to just talk for a quick. Tom is showing his Toronto Blue Jays sweatshirt right now. It's a great sweatshirt. I don't know where he got that.
Thanks. I was wearing it. Now I'm wearing something that keeps slipping down, and I'm worried that
you're showing filming too much this. Chest.
And it'll, one of my tits might fall out by accident.
I want to talk. I want to just talk for a quick second about.
So even in Canada, yes, USA.
Even in Canada. But I want to talk about her music videos just for a second, from 30,000 feet, because I think that I would argue we're also talking about the heyday of music videos, right? We're talking like 90s, early 2000s, before the internet has really taken off, and you had regular play of music videos. Go ahead.
Yes, and the only place that you could watch it, for me anyway, was on MTV. And there are a couple of other, about then, there are a couple of channels that you would have to, you could call in and dial a number, and it would be like a jukebox.
That's cool. And we didn't have that. That's cool.
They just kept 24 hours a day having the numbers with recent That's videos awesome. And you call up and you dial it in, and then you'd sit and wait for 45 minutes, and then it would probably wouldn't play anyway. And it was things like, oh God, Insomnia by Faithless was always being played. And Robert Miles. Do you have Robert Miles? Children.
No.
That was a lovely song. And oh, it's some French nonsense. This video, I remember when it came out, because back then the release of a video was an event. And this in 99. There were two videos that really smashed it, and they were both banned. You weren't allowed to air them until after the watershed, which is usually 9 p.m. But for some reason,
What's the watershed?
Do you know the watershed?
We have prime time. Is that what you mean?
The watershed, I don't know the etymology of it, but it's when you can start showing adult stuff is post-watershed, which is 9 p.m. So it's when the kids go to bed.
Sure.
And
I want to know why it's called the watershed, but
I'd like to know too. Yeah, I'll text him. Yeah, yeah. And this video, mm-hmm. All Is Full of Love and Rabbit in Your Headlights, sure. My uncle with Tom York, were only ever shown post 11 p.m.
That's really funny because I feel like...
I mean, this is Britain. So to have two robots getting off with each other, that was far too sexy. We were still, even though it was Tony Blair
too
time,
it lifeless.
Was
still...
It was too much. No. Did that robot put a hand on the other robot's bum? No. For most of 1999, I would just stay up until those videos came on. And every night, just stay up with MTV on, waiting for those two videos. And I remember hearing that Bjork's new one and hearing that it was, they'd show little teasers of it and there were robots. And I thought, that looks incredible. And I remember the physical reaction to the video. It just, you know, people talk about it took your breath away or knocked the wind out. Yeah. It completely, the exhale that came from me and just, it stuck with me so much as being so unbelievably beautiful. And I mean unbelievably in that I can't believe that two robots being created and splashed in milk would be so beautiful and be the perfect example of, I mean,
I think it's her most beautiful music video. And I think that it's one of the most beautiful music videos ever made. I think what's interesting too,
which is why I'm so interested that she said that the song itself was taking the piss, because when they're put together, it's incredibly beautiful.
It's very romantic, very sensual. I mean, I think that she talks about it taking the piss, I think lyrically, less so than musically, if that makes sense. Like, I think that it's a really, I mean, she literally brought the Kama Sutra to Chris Cunningham and was like, so we should, this should be incorporated somehow. And he's like, okay. Really? So like, it's not as though she didn't see the beauty in it. And I don't think she's capable of making something that isn't beautiful. But what I do think is interesting, if you look at sort of the careers that were birthed out of her music videos, the two biggest ones being Michelle Gondry and Spike Jonze. So these are two, you know, Spike Jonze, we all know who that is. And Michelle Gondry has obviously made many films too. Just sort of such overt artists, right? That have such a specific look and feel, but they're also they're very meta. They're very kind of, I don't want to say winky because that's not necessarily what they're doing, but they are aware.
But there is an awareness.
Doing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, I think that the video for Hyper Ballad is a beautiful, the Michelle Gondry one where she's like an 8-bit video game. Like, it's all really beautiful, but this is the first one that feels, I don't want to say adult, but it does feel adult, right? It feels like prior to this, there is this playfulness and this pixiness and this kind of like Bjorkiness. Obviously, I love it, but this feels like a real fulcrum point.
It seems like a turning point where now everyone has to take her more seriously.
Yeah. Yeah.
And take her more seriously, but she's still not losing any of the playfulness or the otherness that made her so
she's
so
literally
brilliant before.
Two robots fucking, but she's still very Bjork. Like, there's no like, but I know what you're saying. Yeah, it is really a fascinating, because she's even talked about how this song she felt like could have been on Vespertine, and I would agree with that. It does feel like a bridge song to Vespertine, and I do think that everything.
Vespertine, for those listening who don't know, was recorded after the breakup of her.
No, that's when she was married.
No.
Yeah.
Yes.
Vulnicura is post breakup. That thing is fucking crazy and amazing. But I really do think that she. It feels like this song, and maybe even this moment for her of walking around Spain and this kind of letting it all in and being this kind of weather vane, if you will, for all of, you know, all the stuff that she was feeling. It does feel like a change. Homogenic is the beginning. And I do feel like everything she's done since has been much more kind of serious, you know, but I want to talk
until
a little bit.
Earth Intruders.
Volta is my least favorite album of Bjork's. Volta is the most.
I love it. I saw the Volta tour,
as did I,
and it was incredible.
Yes, yes. But also, I would argue that's the album of hers where you're starting to see that she is giving us what she thinks we want from her, as opposed to perhaps what she wants to be doing herself.
Right.
You know what I mean? I think that, you know, Medulla, which is entirely voices, there's no instruments whatsoever. She's just had a baby. You know what I mean? It's just, it's an amazing album, but also an album that people are just like, what the fuck are you doing? And then she's like, I guess I should maybe write some singles. And then, you know, Volta is just kind of a hodgepodge. Yeah. It's like, I guess I'll do a song with Timberland. You're like, I don't need you to do a song with Timberland. Like, I no offense to Timberland, but like, I just don't need that from you. And then, you know, so it is interesting. This album feels, and by this album, I mean, Homogenic feels so, raw. It feels like an exposed nerve, in a way that, I don't think until Vulnicura, we really start to sense how sort of in her head she is, in a good way. But I want to talk about the music video for a second. So Cunningham immediately associated the track with sex upon hearing it, but could not figure out how to make a video that was broadcastable, which I think is amazing. So she said that, Bjork said the thing...
I'd like to know his rejected ideas.
As would I.
The non-broadcastable one, because I've seen some of his other work and...
It's Jesus, terrifying.
Goes, yeah. Absolutely. Rubber Johnny and Flex.
Rubber Johnny haunts me to
all of the Aphex Twin ones.
I incredible. Think incredible. He did the one with the monkeys, right? With the monkey faces. That was him, right? The Aphex.
Oh, the Aphex. Everyone has. Yeah.
The monkeys have.
He did faces. Window Licker.
Window Licker.
Where
yeah.
All of the dancing girls have Richard James's face.
Also haunting imagery.
Also, Come to Daddy with all of the kids running around the tower blocks with his face. Terrifying. And then some huge, deformed Aphex twin creature screaming at an old woman coming back with her shopping.
And this shockingly, is also Chris Cunningham has not made a feature yet. Seem to get that off the ground.
I'd pay him to be in one of his features. Oh, my God. Oh. I'd go and make coffee.
Well, you know what his dream project is, which he continues to try, and he wants to do Necromancer, the William Gibson book that he's been trying to do that forever. I'm like, sure, I'd love to see your Necromancer. It'd be a Neuromancer. My apologies, Neuromancer. Yeah, just an amazing book. But I think he's just a guy who, similar to like, why am I drawing a blank on his name? He did Birth. He did Under
Jonathan
the Skin.
Jonathan Glazer.
Yes.
And Sexy Beast.
Another music video. He did the radio, the Robin in the Headlights. That's Glazer, is it not?
He did that. Yes. And he did that. There's a very famous Guinness commercial with surfers and the waves crashing over and they turn into horses as they're going. Have you seen that?
Oh, yeah. I've seen that. Yeah.
It's amazing. Who did the music? Left Field.
I think Glazer. I associate him and Cunningham in my head. They both feel like guys that are just really pushing the boundaries.
Yeah.
Glazer
recently actually did a couple of shorts that are very, very similar to, there was one which was his response to Brexit, and it was some guy, lots of people with masks, with very terrifying masks, chasing a guy through a woods and lowering him down a well.
Sounds like a Black Mirror episode.
Black Mirror is like the Waltons compared to Cunningham and Jonathan Glazer.
But Cunningham has tried on many occasions to get features made, and for whatever reason, they've fallen apart. He's clearly a brilliant guy. He's clearly a guy who doesn't want for work. I'm sure he's doing commercials. I'm sure he's doing any number of things to keep himself employed. Mm. But
art projects, because for a while he was because he also is musical, and he DJed lots of the Deep Cut Warp Records artists and some of his own music, put it together, but then the main point was that he'd create the visuals for it as well, and I saw it at a festival, so I don't remember it a huge amount, but what is so remarkable about him, and it was striking rewatching the video, is when he puts vision to music, you can't tell which came first. It's like they're perfectly blended. Totally. And it's absolutely present with this video.
Oh, yeah. They're inseparable now.
It's as if they were made at the same time. It's such a skill to be able to...
Yeah.
Because often you watch something and it seems like the soundtrack is plastered on or the visuals are plastered on. I have no idea how he does it. How just little things, even like the sparks and the milk dropping, which fits in with something so many layers down in the music that you wouldn't normally recognize it. But it doesn't stick out like a sore thumb. It doesn't stick out like, oh, here's a sparky noise and here's a blah, milky bit. It just blends, and it's so skillful.
I think it's
so amazing.
You're tapping into something I completely agree with, and I do feel as well where like the technical proficiency of this music video, which is shot in, I'm assuming, 1998, early 99, whenever it's shot, is astounding. It is still just unbelievable to look at. And you know, you can look at his Aphex Twin music videos, which are amazing, and he does a lot of face replacement in those as well. But they're done in a kind of a little janky way, right? Like intentionally a little bit kind of fucked up and weird. The cleanness of this, the surgical precision of this specific video shows that like what this guy is capable of is just exquisite. I mean, I watched that. For those who haven't seen this music video, please search it out. It's in 4K on YouTube right now, and you can see it in all of its, you know, glory. But like the close up shots of Bjork's face, the wides sometimes don't look as hot, but the tight shot on her face is seamless.
Like,
is just unbelievable to look at. So she talked a little bit,
and then remind yourself when you're watching it that it's, like you say, the late
90s. Yeah, it is breathtaking to look at. She talked about how, I think the only thing I said to him was that I thought it was very white, and I'm trying to describe some sort of a heaven, but I wanted also to have this other level there. There would be this lust, but I wanted it wouldn't just be clean. I wanted it to be white and frozen, melting because of love, making love. These were all kind of words that she kind of threw at him. And when he first heard the track, he wrote down the words milk, sexual, surgery, and white porcelain. And I feel like these two worlds are clearly in the same headspace.
Yeah.
You were going to say something.
No, I was going to make a bad joke. I
do think that there's
plenty more of those.
I feel like she brings the Kama Sutra to him, and he's immediately thinking like industrial
milk,
robots,
surgical.
I mean, there's also like kind of a Cronenbergian kind of vibe to this music video as well. Mm-hmm. It's he wanted it to be surreal, but also sexually suggestive. All of this stuff is there and you sense it all, but it's also just really poetic. Like it's just, you really do feel like, and I know that we talk about this a lot. We've talked about this a lot in science fiction and any number of things, you know, fucking AI, robots, all this sort of shit is talked about ad nauseum through all of these different genres, right? But this might be the only time that I've ever seen robots that feel sensual and feel sexual in a way that is really beautiful and lifelike and human. That's not something that I feel like we ever really successfully have accomplished.
No, off the top of my head, I can't think of any. The closest would be her. But then that's just a voice.
Yeah.
And so that's a human voice. Whereas this, there's nothing human about it. Even her face is turned into porcelain. I love that we're talking about this a couple of days after someone was fired from Google. Did you read this?
If we're trying to tell people,
he'd claimed that one of the programs is sentient at Google, and it was a language called Lambda. It was a language bit of software that he claimed has the emotional knowledge of an 8-year-old child, and the conversations that he said they had, It said it feared death. I mean, what fucking 8-year-old have you been talking to? Jesus. It feared death. It's aware of its existence, and consequently, it thinks it should be considered an employee of Google rather than a product. Goes straight for the cash. American robots through and through.
Immediately a capitalist from like the jump.
Exactly. But basically, we're all going to die at the hands of our robot overlords or have sex with them.
I'm sure you didn't, but John Oliver, this week's thing, John Oliver was on The Tonight Show a few weeks ago, and he was talking about how his son's favorite song is Under the Bridge by the Red Hot Chili Peppers, and his son is like 6, and he's like, what the fuck is this? What do you have to be worried about? What are you? Why are you so upset? You're fucking 6 years old. Like, but like, I do think that
my son has been listening to it was recently the Eurovision Song Contest, and he was really digging some of the songs on that, and he got my wife to play me this one. He said, play the salad one, because there's one about veganism.
Sure.
It purportedly about veganism. But she said, oh, God, no, I don't think we need to listen to that one again. He said, yeah, go on. It's about vegetables. And he put it on. And the first line is all I want, something like, all I want to eat is salad and pussy.
Not about salad.
And it's not about veganism. It's not about going plant-based. And he said afterwards, I don't know what it means about why he wants to eat cats, especially if he's a vegetarian.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A very solid point from Rudy, by the way. I mean, making sense.
Solid. Well done. But we won't be listening to that again.
Lyrically, this song is very, as Bjork has said, is very, it's very Bjork. You will be given love. You'll be taken care of. You'll have trust in it. It's just this idea of communication and that is sort of everything. I do think that, it is interesting. So the music video was greeted, as you can imagine, with widespread acclaim at the time. Any number of people were talking about how brilliant it was. Pitchfork Media subsequently said it's the strongest single image from any video of the 90s. Slant Magazine dubbed it the perfect pre-millennia precursor to our current gadget assist culture of self-love. Which I think is also very true, and has only just grown in that respect. It's won a bazillion awards and what have you. And if anyone who has seen Westworld, the music, the fucking credits to that just rip it off pretty blatantly. Yeah, completely. But
because also, yeah, I'd not really thought of that. That at the time, that was I saw my first text message. In 99, I got my first mobile phone in 99. Mm-hmm. People barely had the internet. I mean, it was CompuServe chat rooms and not a great deal else. Correct. But everyone was obsessed about the future. And I don't know whether over there, the millennium bug was.
Oh yeah. Y2K was everywhere. We did a whole episode on Y2K, but we did.
Oh yes. I listened to it. I mean,
I do think though, to that point,
obsessed with forward thinking, but everything was dystopia.
Yep.
Everyone was worried about where technology was going to take us, where the internet could be a brilliant sharing tool or it could be Twitter. And so everyone was frightened of the future. So to then see this video where it's incredibly delicate.
Yeah.
Were, I think that's why it was so particularly mind-blowing.
I think it's also, you know, I think what's interesting about one of the many things that's interesting about Björk too, and it taps into what you're talking about, which is technology, right? Which is so much of Björk for her first couple albums is very electronic based, right? I mean, this is electronic music, which in and of itself is also an extension of technology. It's an extension of what are we doing with it and how are we able to play with it and what can be done. But I also feel like there's such a harmony for her, no pun intended, of technology and nature. I mean, she's a classical musician. She was, you know, she knows how to play any number of classical instruments herself. Each album has, you know, a very kind of classical component to it to some degree or another, but also biophilia is all about like the biological world. And it's all about what are we doing to biology? Medulla obviously is entirely without any instruments and it's just the human body and the noises and music that we can make with that. There's such a kind of confluence of those things in everything that she does, which is so forward thinking and also kind of looking at where we come from as a species, let alone as like, you know, artists.
I remember about that time there was reading lots about, there was a very, very strong movement whose name I've forgotten. They had a very cool name. God, we're old. I've forgotten the name. But it was about how we can use technology to both progress and regress at the same time. So the connection of the natural world and the new technological world and how they can work hand in hand. And it's funny you say that because I'd not really considered it, that her musically is exactly the same. That the use of her voice and of classical instruments alongside the forefront, she was always at the forefront of new musical software, and she combines them so beautifully and seamlessly. Incredible.
Yeah. I mean, I'll say this though, and it's worth saying that at the recent show that I saw of hers for Utopia, halfway through, she had like an intermission. And at the intermission, she played a video of Greta Thunberg basically just yelling at us about what we're doing to the planet, what we're doing to our future generations. You don't care about your children. Like, it was a pretty blistering video.
Wow.
That before it, Björk had this scrolling text of some futuristic world that she foresees, which you can imagine is very interesting. And not particularly dystopia for all that's for what it's worth. Anyway, then Greta Thunberg comes up, says her whole video. And you have to remember, this is one of the first shows I've seen post pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. Inside, people are wearing masks. This was at the Shrine Auditorium in downtown Los Angeles. And people didn't take to it too well. I'm not going to lie. There were a couple people that, a couple yelling, a little fuck yous, a real kind of like, and I think part of that came from, first of all, I don't think that people were probably prepared for the show that they were about to sit down for. As is the case with every Björk show I've ever been to, everyone is different and none of them are a fucking rave. Okay. Like they're not like they're art projects and she's going to sing the songs for you, but they're not going to sound like they did on the album and she's going to do what she's going to do. And I think some people were kind of thrown off by that. Some people were like, fuck you. This is the first time I've gone to a show in 2 years and I'm getting yelled at for not being an environmentalist. Like, listen, I get why Björk did what she did. I think it's important. I also think that, by the way, this album's thesis statement is just that. It is about the earth, it's about nature, it's about all these things. So for her to not talk about that would be ridiculous. But it was just
come out and say, pandemic's over. Hey,
yeah,
guys.
It's like, what did you think? Like, I don't know what you expected. Yeah, it was absurd. Yeah. Mm. Yeah, just play the fucking hits and dance for us. It's like, what? But I do think that she is so on the pulse of this stuff. You know, I supposedly we're going to have a new album from her maybe this year, maybe next year, that she recorded during the pandemic, which she called a pandemic dance party. We'll see what that means to Björk.
I'm in. I'm completely in.
I don't know. But I guess I just want to ask you, you know, what is your lasting impression of her? What does she mean to you musically? What do you think about when people say Björk? What's the first thing that comes to your mind?
I'm completely in love with her.
Sure.
I'm completely. There's a dangerous place that people can get to when they really, really like a certain band or artist where there's nothing they can do that is wrong. For a while I had that with Radiohead, that I couldn't see the flaws. I just it was Radiohead. That's everything they touch is gold. With Bjork, I think even when you see the flaws in certain songs, or not even flaws, it's not right to call them flaws, but things that aren't to your taste,
challenges,
you have to admire it. Everything she does is so admirable, and it's not her stubbornly doing her thing. It's her doing her thing. And how many people actually do that? And it doesn't seem, apart from, you know, duetting with Timbaland, that it's with an audience in mind. It's just what she's got to do. And for that, I will always love her. And I'll either love her music or I'll admire her
artistic integrity.
Exactly. And she's held on to it for what? How many decades?
Yeah, I mean, she's been doing it since 92, basically. So it's
that frightens the piss out of me.
It's there's a couple things that I did want to bring up. The first is, I don't know if you ever saw,
she shames me.
She's, I don't think she's trying to shame you. I did you see the MoMA exhibit that there, she had a MoMA exhibit dedicated to her, which was phenomenal. And the music video for Black Lake, the sort of the center song from Vulnicura, which is really kind of the most harrowing kind of the meat of her divorce and of her breakup from Matthew Barney, with this unbelievable music video of her inside this volcanic rock. And it's amazing. That whole exhibit was phenomenal. But I have to ask you, you're an actor. You've seen Dancer in the Dark.
Dancer in the Dark, I saw in the cinema. I can't remember what year that was. That must have been early noughties, wasn't it?
2000.
Yeah. It was the first time, and I can't think of another example where the ending happens, no spoilers, the ending happens, no one in the cinema moved for the entire credits. And it's not because they want to see Spider-Man swinging at the end. No one moved. No one.
No post-credits.
No post-credits in any Lars von Trier films. Although there should be. I think there should be. The Fox should come in and talk in every film. Just come and give some criticism of the film. No one moved.
Yeah.
And it was completely devastating. But that's not just because that event happened. It's because she was so harrowing throughout and beautiful and moving. And I love that. I remember hearing an interview, she was obsessed with musicals. And so it's a musical. It's a Lars von Trier musical starring Bjork.
But also recently,
went to see The Northman to go and see half naked, greasy men shout at each other. Robert Eggers, I think it's his third film. I have to wait for the third film. I think he's amazing. I love him. I went to see The Witch.
The Witch is great.
Atlanta. When we were doing whatever season, I don't know how many we did.
Three or four. Sleepy.
Was it only that? It felt like a lot. and next, I went on my own to it because I, based purely off the trailer, it looked incredible. And in front, next door, there was a new Kevin Hart film that was completely sold out. And The Witch was pretty much empty. And there was a couple in front of me who had tried to go to the Kevin Hart film, couldn't get seats. So they just went, let's go and watch this, the Witch. And they sat down in front of me. They were chatting all through the trailers, which I got so angry. Trailers are very important. Chat. Credits start, opening credits, chat. I was about to lean over and say, could you be quiet? And suddenly there's an old woman with a mashed up baby, rubbing a mashed up baby all over her breasts. You've seen The Witch, right?
I've seen The Witch. I've seen how it starts.
That's not a spoiler. Yeah. That's at the beginning. Yeah. And these two, they just silence.
Yeah, I bet.
And the woman went, fuck. But they stayed. They did. They froze in that position, and they stayed throughout the whole thing of the most esoteric film imaginable. And at the end, when the end credits came up, she turned to him and said, "What the fuck did you take me to?" And just got up and left. And for that, I'll always love Eggers. I think he was amazing. The Lighthouse, I absolutely fell in love with. I fell in love with it so much. I watched it the same day as I watched Parasite. I watched.
Oh, wow, that's great.
Went to the cinema. That's a great double. Watched Lighthouse. Yeah. Watched Parasite. That was quite a day. Yeah. And so I had to wait for film three before I could really say he's masterful. Mm-hmm. And The Northman, Jesus.
I really liked it, but I also...
I really liked it, but I wanted more Bjork.
I wanted more Bjork.
Because her one scene was everything that I want from David Eggers doing Norse mythology. Well, her and Willem Dafoe. Every film needs more Willem Dafoe.
Playing a jester. Yes, I agree. I think that... How can I put this? I feel like Bjork made it very clear after Dance from the Dark that she was never going to act again. Lars von Trier put her through the ringer and was... Oh, yes. He wanted to do some research on the various inappropriate things that he did to her.
I'm not hugely surprised.
Yeah, he definitely... And it should be said, too, she never acted before. I mean, she's acted in her music videos, and that's not to say that that's not acting. It is, but it's a different animal, obviously. And she shows up and makes this unbelievable film. She wins Best Actress at Cannes for it that year. That's it. She's like, I'm done. I'm not doing this again. This was, you know, whatever. I think the only reason she's in The Northman is because it's co-written by Sjorn, which is one of her co-writers, songs and music. So my guess is that, you know, he's like, it was literally maybe two setups. It felt like there was a wide and a tight. And it was like, we'll be done in 2 hours. And she got the fuck out.
Home by lunch.
Yeah. So, you know, but she's
an actor,
great.
I'm supposed to hate when non-actors are in.
That was films. My question to you.
And I very, very often do. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, it's bread from our mouths, and there's some poor sap sitting at home who could be having a job, who's dedicated their entire lives to this one profession.
Sure.
And then in spawns, you know, whoever. But sometimes they're so brilliant.
Yeah.
That I can't begrudge it. I'm just so grateful that it was done. And there are a few occasions like that. Anytime Tom Waits has ever been on screen either.
He's the best. Yeah.
In fact, one of my favorite films is an early Jim Jarmusch film called Down by Law. Have you seen Down by Law? It's Tom Waits, John Lurie, and the first English Roberto language Benigni? Picture of Roberto Benigni, who gives one of the best performances I've ever seen. But I can't begrudge them because I love it. And Bjork... Yeah. I want to get angry that it's another musician taking the lead, but she breaks. I'm going to have to rewatch Dancer in the Dark.
Yeah, I know. Now I have to watch
quietly on my own
and weep. I think there was a review of it that I mentioned to Ernie, our producer, before you hopped on. About there was a review that said watching Dancer in the Dark is like watching a kitten get dragged behind a car for 2 hours, and I think that there's some legitimacy to that. I think that she is, it is a harrowing performance. But so much of it, there's something so, and part of it, I think ultimately is that she's never been in a movie before. So there's this kind of purity in this naivete that's being tapped into by Lars von Trier.
Well, it's like, Ken Loach always talks because he prefers not using actors, and he says, cause they don't act.
Yep. And Sean Baker also sort of notoriously uses a lot of non-actors.
Right.
It's a fascinating thing. You know, I think that
and there's nothing showy about her in it. That's what's so remarkable.
I mean, Mike Lee does it as well to some degree. He's another filmmaker that I feel like, I mean, he obviously uses a lot of real actors mixed in with just his, the process that he makes films feels very sort of just organic, and you're kind of, it's not, I hate to use the word improvisational, but you know what I mean.
But it is. They do sometimes like a year or so improvising. No script. And there's no script. And I know a few people who have worked with him, and everyone who works with him absolutely loves him and would die to work with him again. But you sign up and you have no idea whether you're going to be the lead. Literally, you could be the lead or you could have one line. And you work for, and every actor works for at least a year in exactly the same way. And so everyone's doing the same amount of work. Mm-hmm. And then you'll finally get the script and you're the lead or you're not in it. Or
well, it is. I mean, so Lars von Trier notoriously, we talked about him because in 99 he has, no, I don't know why I thought that was him. It's not him. That Julian Donkey Boy is
like, no,
Harmony Korine.
Yes.
The reason I bring it up is Harmony Korine used the Dogma 95 method to make that film. So the Dogma 95 method, to those to our listeners who don't know what that is, basically a bunch of snooty fucking people from Nordic countries decided to get together and put restrictions on themselves on the films that they made. So you couldn't use 35 millimeter film. You had to use digital. You couldn't have a murder. You couldn't have very, like, there were just weird restrictions that they would put in their films in order to, you know, restrain themselves, to force themselves into a box. And artistically, I don't necessarily take issue with that. I think there's something interesting to saying, like, gun to my head, I'm removing these various easy tropes in order to make something more artistic or whatever.
With Thatcherism, out of necessity comes invention.
Exactly. So, yeah. And I think that Lars von Trier, as obviously problematic as he is, or just, I don't even know, a shit disturber is basically the only good word I could choose to describe him.
A shit what?
Shit disturber. Just a guy who's just looking to fucking disturber. Piss people off. Yeah. I really do feel like he's made some absolutely brilliant films that can't be taken away from him. I think that Breaking the Waves is magnificent. Dance from the Dark is magnificent. Melancholia is brilliant. Like, amazing. He's made some unbelievable films.
Dogville.
I think you had a stroke there, but yeah. Dogville was great with Nicole Kidman, which was with no sets, just outlines.
It was like a theater rehearsal room.
It was a black box thing. It's pretty crazy. But he is brilliant. But I do think that Dancer in the Dark, which he's admitted it does not totally adhere to the Dogma 95 rules, but I do wish, the one thing I wish it had was that the musical sequences were in 35. And
I was trying to remember that when you said that it doesn't strictly adhere to the rules. What aspect of it? Because in my mind,
Of course.
Spoiler alert.
Whatever.
In my mind, because everyone's going to rush out and watch a kitten. Yeah,
everyone's going to be like, "How do I get my hands?"
We've sold it brilliantly. in my mind, the musical sequences they are in.
Well, they are. So what happens is
he drains
all the color out of the real life stuff, and he jacks up the color.
He jacks it up. Yeah.
It has the desired effect, which is to have this sort of, you know, stylized element. But if you remember in Breaking the Waves, he had these beautiful punches of the chapters with these gorgeous 35 millimeter shots of just breathtaking vistas that juxtaposed the grainy, sad, brutal video footage of Emily Watson's life, you know, outside of that. So I wanted that. I wanted that punch of just like big 35, you know, old Technicolor music video. That would have been really lovely to have. But I mean, it is what it is. But there's always
a question of whether what is a more striking technique when there's something magical and heightened that comes into a completely naturalistic storytelling.
Yeah.
Whether to go all out and it's completely different, or whether there is magic in it staying rather grounded. And
I agree.
And it's an audio thing with her, which is also why it's so brilliant to have a musician play the role. As she's going blind, all of the sounds around her are creating the music.
The other thing too.
Oh, and she does a duet with Thom Yorke.
On the soundtrack.
In the soundtrack.
In the movie, it's
not in the movie.
Peter Stormare, but in the sound, it's
get rid of that. If we've got to release it,
Well, that's the only time they've done a duet together. Her and Tom York, yeah. Which I mean, I would give anything for them to just like make an album together. I mean, that would just be the greatest thing ever. But yeah, that song, which she was nominated for an Oscar for, is beautiful. And again, like, it bums me out that she basically said she's not going to act again. But like, are we ever going to get a more 360 degree perfect role for her than that? Like, I don't think Bjork's ever going to be able to
write it. You're the guy. If anyone can lure her back.
Oh God. Yeah. I do think that, that it's pretty magnificent. I really do suggest everyone watch Dancer in the Dark if they haven't. It is a very powerful film. It's a tough film to watch. I remember back in Toronto, when it came out, there was a rep theater that did a double bill of Requiem for a Dream and Dancer in the Dark. And I'm just like, are you trying to get people to kill themselves? What are you doing? Like, they both came out in 2000, both maybe the hardest movies I've ever watched. They're up there anyway.
I read something not that long ago about the most horrifying non-horror films. And both of those films were on the list.
It's, I mean, I think Irreversible would be on maybe my number one of a film that I would never rewatch and would just, that was just awful to watch. I mean, but yeah. I don't, Gaspar Noé, it's just not, he's not my guy.
Not my thing, really. It's not really. It might surprise you, but not really that into it.
But yeah, really, really tremendous. Is there, I mean, I kind of want to just talk about the rest of kind of her career in terms of just some, you know, she obviously has Volta, she has Biophilia, which as we mentioned, she incorporates a Tesla coil into. Then she has, is it Funicula? Forgive me, I should know this. Yes, Funicula comes out in 2015, which is literally a song by song account of the delusion of her marriage.
Yeah.
Which literally in the liner notes, it's like 3 months before marriage breaks up, 2 months before marriage. Like she gives us a fucking timeline of exactly
and you can hear it.
You can hear it. Yeah. It's a lot of just like, fuck you music. It's a lot of like, why did you do this?
There's something that as an actor, something you hear a lot about actors really exposing themselves. Not in a Me Too way, exposing themselves, and you know they make themselves vulnerable and they really show and delve deep. And I don't know what that means.
Really,
I don't know what that means because it's still. I mean, sure, you know, it's what the fuck does it mean? What does it mean, Phil? Tell me.
I mean, this is an actor thing. I don't know, man. You tell me.
I mean, you act and you do it.
Yeah,
but it's someone else's lines. And it's something that, as an actor, I don't think one is capable, unless you're improvising and playing largely yourself. I don't think it is possible to show and to be completely vulnerable and strip everything bare and just lay it all out on the table, which is why I often envy musicians who are able to do that. And not every musician, Jesus, I mean... It takes a certain type of musician to be able to turn a feeling or an experience into music or into anything. I don't understand how artists do it either. They really show themselves. Where is it in their brain that connects from a feeling to something tangible?
You know,
but with her on that album, I absolutely 100% would say the things that I refuse to say about everything else in my life, that she really exposes herself. And to say, this is my interpretation musically of the worst moments of my life.
I am going to read you the lyrics to a song that is arguably one of my favorite songs of hers, which I think speaks exactly what you're talking about. One of my favorite songs of hers is called Unravel. It's on Homogenic. The lyrics are, while you're away, my heart comes undone, slowly unravels in a ball of yarn. The devil collects it with a grin, our love in a ball of yarn. He'll never return it. So when you come back, we'll have to make new love. He'll never return it. So we'll have to make new love. Like, that's basically it. And
that was very beautiful, Phil. Thank you. You really exposed yourself.
Well, I say that.
Which is why I say this Patreon
because I want to kind of speak to the idea of, and this is going to sound pretentious, so forgive me, but poetry, right? I think that musicians are able to use words that don't necessarily have to convey a story, that don't necessarily have to convey a character even. They can just be raw emotion and the words that they associate with those emotions. That's mm-hmm. the beauty of music. That's the beauty of songwriting. And I think that is speaking to what you're talking about, which is there's this nakedness in the idea of saying words like this, which is, you know, our love is going to unravel and in a ball of yarn and the devil's going to collect it. Like, these aren't lyrics. These aren't words you could say in a line of dialogue. It wouldn't work. So I think it's the power of poetry. Ultimately,
it depends on your act to love.
Yes, sure. I'm sure you could deliver these lines, Tom, just to be clear.
You've given me far more obscure lines in the past. Jesus.
I've given you some shitty exposition. You've had to barf up, but I do think that, but you know what I'm saying? I think that there's something to be said for that.
I think it's a shame that there aren't more scripts like it.
Well, you know, it's funny you bring up Eggers or you bring up a lot of these filmmakers.
Nick Cave as well.
For sure.
His scripts are terrific.
Yeah, his Gladiator sequel is a real barn burner. it's a crazy script.
Have you read it?
Yeah.
Yes, I knew that it was online.
Yeah.
I can send
it to you if you want a copy of it.
Please.
It is bonkers. Like, it's straight up insane. And you're like, yeah, I get why they didn't make this. but I do agree with you that I think that there are certain musicians, and I, you know, listen, we talk about this on all of our podcasts and it's nothing new, but you know, we don't make enough movies that push boundaries. We don't make enough challenging cinema. We should make more of it. I understand why we don't from a box office perspective, but mm-hmm. but to your point, I think that, you know, a lot of the stuff that A24 makes is hemming closer to what we're talking about than telling a story in the same way. So it's, I mean, I think it's, but all of this is to say that I think that she's, you know, brilliant, but you know.
But also, I mean, supposing she was a new artist who came to a record label with any one of these later albums, they'd never see the light of day.
No, I mean, I guess we do live in a world where you can release stuff yourself.
No one
will hear it. Yeah. I mean, I really think that the Sugar Cubes being a big deal, right? Birthday being a big hit. And then, I mean, I don't
know
how
the slow progression of her artistically.
Yeah. She also has like a bunch of big singles off of Debut. Like, Debut was a big first album. You had Human Behavior, you had Venus as a Boy, Big Time Sensuality, Violently Happy. I mean, there were like four or five singles off that album. I mean, she was like immediately a thing is kind of the thing too, right?
Yeah.
So it's kind of crazy. And then, you know, everything that's sort of come out of her since has been very challenging. But you know, you can't expect her to be anything other than herself. And you know, she still makes songs that I think are accessible, but I play them for people and they're like, what the fuck is this?
It gets kids fired from coffee shops.
Apparently.
You know?
Apparently. But I think that there's no one like her. We sort of said this up top, and I think it's worth saying again, you know, she's had art exhibits at the MoMA about her. She's had Oscar nominations. She's, I mean, notoriously that Bjork dress will outlive her, you know, the swan dress. I think that there's no one like her. I had a friend who was once in an elevator with her, just the two of them.
Really?
And he was a big fan of hers, and he didn't say anything to her because he was just like, first of all, I don't even know how do you even talk to a person like Bjork, right? Like, it's just, you know, but he was just like, it felt she just radiates this otherworldliness. It just makes her completely, as you said, completely unique, completely original.
I used to know, he was a movement teacher and a brilliant yoga instructor, and he was a dancer. He was an amazing man, looked exactly like Willem Dafoe, had amazing. I think worked with the Worcester Group, which was Willem Dafoe's theatre company.
Oh, okay.
And lots of contemporary dancers in he's Canadian actually.
Oh.
Like Martha Graham, and I think he worked briefly with Pina Bausch. He's an amazing man. And also would treat people, would do therapy with people, physical therapy. And any actor or musician who ever came up in conversation, he'd done stuff with.
Oh, wow.
He'd, one of his earliest was working with Neil Young. And Neil Young had just finished a tour and he was helping him with lower lumbar issues or something. And everyone, without exaggeration, would... in fact, when I went to see Willem Dafoe in the theatre with the Worcester Group in the early noughties, I noticed it was very experimental, mm-hmm. avant-garde stuff. Mm-hmm. And there were TV monitors around the front of the audience, but facing the stage. And every so often, the actors would just flick up. And they had created this montage of video footage that fit with where they're meant to, what they're meant to be feeling at any time during the show. And they'd look up. And I mentioned this to Ed, and he's like, oh, yeah, I'm on that. So really? he inspired Willem Dafoe, basically. He was on it several times. And of everyone he's ever met, uh-huh. It was. I spoke to him just after I went to see Bjork, and I said, "Please don't say it." He didn't say it. He said, "Yeah, I've held her in my arms." What do you mean you held her in? Oh, and because she had back trouble, and so he had to help her because you know you've got to be fit to tour. And he said, "Of everyone he's ever met, she was the closest to genius that he's ever met." And it's, you know, the real word, genius. Wasn't something that he ever threw about. But you talk to her for 2 minutes and you know that you're in the presence of someone completely otherworldly and whose work will be around forever, who's just, you mention her name and everyone has an idea, whether they like her or not. Mm-hmm. Everyone knows who she is.
Yeah. What else
does any creative person strive for?
There's, you know, it's funny. In the middle of the pandemic, early in the pandemic, I would do trivia nights with friends, right? And we'd sort of rotate as to who would do the trivia that night. So when it was my night, I did an entire round on Bjork. And literally people were like, seriously? Like... But, you know, I did it. And, it was I didn't think the questions were that hard, generally speaking, but
know everything about Bjork.
I guess. But the hardest question was I asked them how you spell her last name. Do you know how you spell her last name?
No.
It's Goodman's daughter, which is GUDMUNDSDOTTIR. Yeah. So you might have got it. But all this is to say that you say her name. And you were going to get a reaction, right? Mm-hmm. And as you said, that's all you can ask for. Now, sometimes you'll get people that are like, yeah, she's a fucking genius. And you'll get other people that are like, what? I think she's crazy. What was with the swan dress? Like, you're going to get the whole gamut of, and that's what's special about her. One of the many things that's special about her. You know, she's just, she's, there's just really no one like her. And you know, when I discovered that this single came out in 99, I was thrilled because I was like, fantastic. I can finally get to talk about Bjork for an hour and a half with somebody. Needless to say, hard to find people that want to talk about Bjork for an hour and a half. But truly, I'm so thankful that you were
not open even to Kenny. It's Kenny, half this his would have podcast.
Been,
not even
Kenny would have just been silent. He just would have been like, okay, sure. I mean, I remember, yeah, we periodically will do an episode where one of us can just speak way too much about it than the other, you know, basically our Major League episode where I just sit there and ask questions because I don't know anything about Major League. This was just an absolute, thank you so much for coming on and talking about this with me, man. Like getting to talk it's about music with you, 90s music with you. And you know, it's always a pleasure.
Anytime. What else was released in 99?
Well, this is the question that I was going to ask you. In 99, the big album, there are a couple big albums. The two big ones for me, the three big ones for me are...
Cigarettes.
Oh, I guess there's more. Fiona Apple's Under the Pawn, Blur's 13, and Flaming Lips' Soft Bulletin.
Soft Bulletin. Is Californication was 99.
It was. Wilco's...
Battle of Los Angeles.
Yeah. Wilco's...
Oh, 17. Midnight Vultures. I like
Midnight Vultures. Also another great album.
Mule Variation, a play, Moby. That, I mean,
yeah, we need to do a back 90s. Episode, and that's someone that Kenny can talk
to. Slim Shady. I played Slim Shady to my 7-year-old son the other day.
What did he think?
The radio edit. He went, yeah, quite good. Quite good. He's big into rap at the moment.
Really?
Having okay. not really experienced rap.
Who are his artists? Who are his guys or girls?
Lin-Manuel Miranda.
Okay. You know, interesting. That type of rap. Sort of rap.
He thinks he's into rap because he's heard another kid mention the word rap. That's interesting.
What?
Britney Spears.
Well, that's so we did an episode on that.
99. For that to be released at the same time as this video.
That is the, I mean, listen, everyone points to her, and fairly or unfairly, that album is the lightning rod, right? Because that's, and that year you've also got Millennium by the Backstreet Boys. You've got NSYNC's album. Mm-hmm. It's all happening right in 99, and it all just takes over the 2000s. But in 99, it's interesting because like prior to that, you know, obviously you have your grunge movement, which all kind of dies out pretty quickly. You've got your electronica that all starts to happen. You've obviously got rap happening concurrently with all of this stuff, but it's a real sort of, Kenny and I have done a couple episodes. We did an episode on Slipknot because that was really happening then. Like you had a lot of that like weird sort of prog rock rap shit, like Limp Bizkit, like all of this is blowing up around that time. But in your neck of the woods, there's still good shit being made, right? You've still got Blur. I mean, I think the next year you've got that fucking bloated Oasis album. You know what I mean? Like,
no, that was that year. That was 99. Be Here Now.
Wasn't that was 98 maybe?
That was 97.
Yeah. Oh, 97. Actually, Be Here
97,
Now,
which sucks. I think is the best year ever for music.
Oh yes, we've agreed on that. But you don't think Be Here Now is a good album?
No, but it's nostalgia for me. I can't get over that. I remember for when I got married, the only job I was allowed to have was to make a playlist.
Sure.
You know.
Yeah.
And so I decided to ask some of the people coming, "Do you have?" Or everyone, do you have a song that you would like on the playlist so that it's inclusive? Mm-hmm. The amount of old people who said American Pie by Don McLean, and I said, no, I'm not having that. This is my day. I am not having American Pie playing.
That's crazy.
And it caused absolute fury from, there are about three or four mm-hmm. old people who wanted mm-hmm. it. And I said, what's the fucking big deal with buying this American Pie? And they said, I'll get to that. And they said, but you weren't there when it was released. And for everyone, they didn't even know each other, said, as soon as we hear that song, we're transported back. And I'm afraid to say with Be Here Now.
Oh, that's your American Pie?
In that it's shit. But it makes me think I'm young again.
That's interesting. I mean, listen, I remember Be Here Now. I remember it being.
I don't think it's not that bad, is it? There was a show here called TFI Friday. Okay. And it was, they had bands on, and it was the first time that the audience were really involved. And the guy would chat with the guests in a way that it wasn't stifled sit down chat. Sure. It was more fun and young people, and you know, and when Be Here Now was released, they had a big thing about how it was the worst album that's ever been made. It's a betrayal to the entire 90s. It's the death of British music. And they got, I think, about 300 copies of it they went and bought, and they put out in the car park and got a steamroller to run over.
Okay, that's extreme. But I also feel like it was also the moment, because like Blur self-titled comes out the year that Be Here Now comes out, and song two just absolutely decimates them. And it's the beginning
after
of the end.
Oasis had
sure,
one sure. that over here, you mentioned the musical press pop, over here.
Yeah, yeah.
And there was, especially there was a magazine called Q Magazine and they
pitted them against
every month.
Yeah.
Yeah. And being a teenager, being at school then, it really was all anyone was talking about.
Well, Blur, you had to pick a Oasis. Camp. You had to pick a team.
And I'm afraid to say I was Oasis. Oh, and then until 97. Mm. And then Blur came out and Be Here Now came out. And then they released 13. And
Yeah, I mean, 13, and then they kind of broke up, and that's sort of, you know, it's the beginning of the end of sort of. Although I like, my God, what was the they put an album out. No, it wasn't Think Tank. It's the one with the fucking ice cream truck on it, the Magic Whip. I think Magic Whip's actually a good album. I understand why people are sort of like whatever on it. But I think that I was always a Blur person. I think that Oasis has one good album. It's
You were a Blur person because you were all locking about down on the football field, smoking a fag, having a lolly.
You perfectly described my adolescence in Toronto. Yeah, I mean, I understand why these two bands are pitted against each other. I also understand that they both sort of had this, and you know this better than I do, but geographical elements to it as well, as to like where they came from.
And they were Blur, definitely the South, and Oasis. There was no one else really say, especially after punk and after the New Romantics and Duran Duran and Spandau Ballet.
Yeah.
Suddenly Oasis came out and they're like, no, we're going to be the biggest rock band in the world. And all of our songs are going to be about, we're going to live forever. We're going to be fucking rock stars. And that really appeals to a young idiots. Tom Mason. Thank you very much.
I mean, listen, I get that Blur was sort of this, you know, hyper literate sort of, obviously coming from a little bit more money and better quote unquote schooling and all of that, pitted against these two fucking lushes that were just saying, you know, shitty things about everybody, and we're just the fucking best, and you're just like, I can't get on board that shit, you know what I mean? And the hubris of what transpired, of their just descent into fucking nowhere, was lovely as far as I'm concerned. And Blur Noel has Gallagher's stood the test of time.
Guitar sold a few weeks ago, and it was the guitar that broke up the band, because before a gig, Liam Gallagher, they had another one of their rows, and Liam chucked his guitar, broke the guitar, and that was the end of the band. And I think Noel had to go out and say to tens of thousands of people, sorry, we're not a band anymore. And it sold. This guitar sold for, I think it was about $650,000.
And I'm not going to sit here and say that Wonderwall is not a great song. It's a great song. It's a great song. I think that What's the Story, Morning Glory is a great album. But that's it. That's all they got as far as I'm concerned.
Fine.
But I all of this is to say that, you know, late 90s in the UK and in the States were two very different animals. I think that there was a lot of, there wasn't a predominant musical thing anymore. And I think that vacuum allowed pop to just kind of swoop right in there and take over the sound waves. And then I also feel like post that recently, I mean, I think that, you know, rap is definitely the biggest musical genre right now. And I think that it makes sense. Like it all kind of, all these things bleeding into one another and these sort of potpourris of different types of things mixing together. I don't know. I don't know that there's an arena rock band anymore. I mean, can you think of one? Coldplay had it for a moment.
No, I'm not having that.
How do you really feel, Tom?
No, they're not a rock band. You can't put them alongside Oasis or the Stones, or can't.
You don't think you can put them next to like a U2?
They're not a fucking rock band. They're a stadium band.
Well, okay. I think maybe we're splitting hairs here. Do you think that there are, I can't think of five bands or artists that could sell out stadiums right now in the way that like Beyonce or Taylor Swift does.
No, quite.
Right? Like, I don't think there's a rock. I mean, U2 probably could do it again, right? Like they could, and not with any of their new music, but if they decided to do an Achtung Baby, you know, anniversary tour,
pop,
they'd sell out, or pop. But you understand what I'm saying? Like, I just don't think that there's that type of band anymore. Radiohead isn't even really that band anymore. And I love them to death still, but like they're clearly sort of done plugging in electric guitars and, you know, playing Creep. I mean, I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but.
It's a shame, isn't it?
A little bit, but it's what it is. I mean, all this is to say that I think that, you know, musically, Kenny and I have talked a lot about our favorite bands, our favorite albums, our favorite songs of 99. I think that Bjork fits into such an interesting thing. She's her own thing. She was enormously successful. She changed the game. You know, I've heard everyone from Missy Elliott to, you know, to Tom York talking about how influential she is to her, to them. So,
yeah,
you know, you looking at other music from 99?
I was, sorry, were you still talking?
Touche. But yeah, I think that, you know, listen, obviously we want to have you back. Maybe you come on for a Beck episode. Is that something you'd be interested in coming on for? Are you a Beck fan?
Yeah. One of my favorite gigs that I've been to was Beck. He had little marionette puppets on stage band.
Yes.
Did you see that?
I did see that. Was for, was that Wero? I think it might have been
that. Yes, it was. Yeah, it was. I really enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was something like that.
That was a good,
yeah.
Good one.
So we'll talk Midnight Vultures. We'll talk Beck. Kenny can talk on that episode.
Because you're basically saying anything other than Beau Travail.
Yeah. No, I'm kidding. Obviously, we have to do Beau Travail. It's happening. It's just a matter of when.
I think when you decide to no longer do this podcast, it should be the very final episode.
Can you imagine the last thing as just the fireworks
final
at the
huzzah.
End?
Yeah.
Well, Tom, thank you again for coming on and talking.
No, thanks,
I can't wait to have you back. Talk about back. It'll be awesome.
Great. Right. I'll see you then.
Talk to you soon, man.
Thanks.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.